where you get into the problems is okay, Einstein's idea works for big objects, but then how can it be that if this is the way the universe is, that if it works for there, then it doesn't work here? How can the laws of the universe break down? And so what you can say is, oh, okay, that hypothesis works here, but it breaks down there, so that's a problem. But biocentrism doesn't break down. So a good theory in theory is not going to break down or contradict the data or the information. Space and time aren't like these objects of the floor. We all know that. And you look out over the horizon and they go forever. What is space? You know there's something wrong there, that they're not things out there. And so you intuitively know that, right? Think about the dreams again. You're dreaming. Your eyes are closed, and all you have is information. So how can information be turned into space and time when you're with your eyes closed in bed? You're able to fly. You're able to move your hands. That's just information. Your mind is creating space and time. It's creating it. It's creating it when you're dreaming. How can you be in bed, right, and actually move and walk? That's just information that your mind has created space and time. It's created it. And Thoreau really, actually, you think about Thoreau and Emerson, they were two American transcendentalists. And they along with Lauren Isley and myself, all sort of think the same way, that it's a transcendental reality. That's why I identify more with artists and creative types, because at least they're open-minded and able to try to, see things, a little less rigidly than, some of my colleagues. And so yeah, I think that, you see elements of this, in a lot of places. Not so much in science, but elsewhere, yes. We mentioned Emerson. Oh, I mean, he's got it right on the nail. His poetry, he's got this right. Go back and read him. And, he figured out how to express it in poetry. And he really had a real good grasp of this. So you go back and you read that, and you go, wow, that guy's brilliant. And he had it exactly right. He talks about, the unity, getting the diversity from unity and being in a holy spot where suddenly, you're conscious. The phraseology is just, it's unbelievable. If you go through and read some of his essays, they're so poetic, but they're right on, and very accurate. What space and time are that's the language of consciousness. That's how everything you can think or know or experience happens. And without that, there is no such thing as a concept or an idea or an experience or sensations or anything. So those are the tools. That is the information system that we use for everything. And, and whether that's, you're colorblind or you're going to see colors or whether you're the bird or whatever, but that's all, and then we all go back further than that. Like I said, I always like to say, you go back and, we're made up of carbon. And if you follow the logic back, that carbon was made in the heart of supernova exploding stars. And you can follow that logic all the way back. That's all spatial temporal logic from a genome based creature. And like I said, being speculative, I'm sure there may be other information systems out there, but there's no way, with us working with space and time as our tools that we can really fathom what that's about. If you are connected by the energy, which is what you are, that's everything that's associated with you, that you know that all these things have to happen a certain way. And so then you talk about, okay, well, the particles are put together a certain way, so the strong and weak nuclear force and electromagnetic force and these things. Those are just basically, I'm sure you could break those up into other categories, subdivide them and all. But they're basically just the way the world is put together, in terms of the system. So, if you think about it, if I have this bottle, again, if I were to look a little smaller down into that spatial temporal logic, it's not that it would be natural for a chipmunk or a lower animal to ever have to use the spatial temporal reasoning for that purpose, but we as a scientist can get microscopes and electron microscopes, and we can find out that this is made up of molecules that are assembled this way or that way, and then actually go smaller and smaller till we finally come to the very, very bottom where you basically get down to just energy, electromagnetic energy moving in a multiplicity of configurations. So all we're really doing is, Lauren Isley actually said it really well, is that all science has really done is extended our sense perceptions, whether it's through a telescope or a matter microscope. And all those forces and all those things we're doing is just investigating how that logic plays out. So even if you drop the apple or you jump off the roof, you'll get more information about how it works. But again, think of it like a calculator. Yeah, I guess. Okay. No, but more realistically, think about it like a calculator. You know, you take your new calculator back from the store, take it out of a plastic container, and you multiply 4 times 4, and it comes out 16, even though that number has never been multiplied. Or, you know, 16 minus, you know, 4, and you get 12. And you can do all these things, even though no one may ever multiply them or ever do it. It's a system that will always, whenever you multiply or divide, will do this calculation. And it's the same with your mind. I mean, yes, you know, people get into injuries and nails go through their head and all sorts of things, and you can mess up with it. You can take drugs and to do it. But by and large, there's a way that information is being assembled. As a matter of fact, it's very amazing. I mean, you know, not that biocentrism is going to shed any particular light on it, but you know, you probably know more about it than I do. I remember there was a patient that was blind, totally blind, but if you put a pole up in front of them, that he would actually duck, because the information for vision is all multiple pieces that are assembled into that. And so I think that, you know, you're talking about a lot of information that is goes into it. For instance, if I move my head real fast, you know, the room doesn't seem to move. In other words, your mind always keeps it steady. Even though I may be blinking or my eyes moving back and forth, you don't just keep going back and forth. Your mind is keeping it stable. So there's a lot of logic, spatial temporal logic, if you want to have it, and all that goes into that, very much like a calculator or your DVD or your CD player. It's probably a little bit more complicated. Everything is consciousness. I mean, space and time are tools, it's the language of consciousness. So everything right here that you're experiencing, everything that's happening is happening. It's a construct. Everyone that's in your consciousness is here. Yeah, yeah. But that's where it gets really tricky, and that's where the multiple worlds and stuff comes in, is that, you know, to the best of our ability, it appears as though that those particles going through the two whole experiments can have, you know, this is the statistical probability of the wave function, is that they have a range of possible potentials of what they could be or where they could be, and only when you observe it do they collapse to one of those. And what the many worlds view says is that each of those possibilities corresponds to its own history or universe. So that if I flip that switch in the experiment where it decided what the particle did in the past, you know, one gives you a different history, a different universe, and the other, I'm still the same person flipping the switch, but both is different paths and probably the same in the future. And it's hard for us to wrap our mind around that, because you say, well, we're all in this room. Well, we're all in this room according to the certainty that you've collapsed, but there's an uncertainty as to what will happen outside that. So I had one piece where I went back to like JFK, who killed JFK, and said that it may not be determined yet who killed JFK. And they go, what? You know, that's sort of crazy. And so you go back to the Schrodinger's cat experiment, where, you know, the Schrodinger's cat experiment where they put the cat in the box and, you know, the poison goes in, and there's a 50-50 chance that particle will be released, and if the particle is detected, it'll release a poison gas and kill the cat. And so the question is there were all these great famous debates with Niels Bohr and all the great physicists, and they always won. In the end, it was the Copenhagen interpretation, is that cat is neither alive or dead until it's actually observed. And even now, Stephen Hawking is basically, with his philosophy now, not philosophy, his science, the top-down cosmology is that the past and the future exist only as potential. And so what is going on, going back to the JFK analogy, is say there were two sharpshooters that aimed at him, okay, and they had a 50-50 chance of killing him, okay? until you go back and investigate, you don't know which one killed. So one person could have killed in one circumstance and one, and actually both probably would exist if it was a 50-50 chance. And so as you collapse more and more information, the fluidity of the system gets narrower, very much like the two-hole experiment. So it's very hard to put your mind around, but you are, as you move through life, you're collapsing a probability in a whole range of things around you. But there's also fluidity, like if I was on the ground, as to beneath me, what's underneath me? So, you know, would there be sand or a rock, or was there a glacial movement? And there's a certain probability that it could even be a diamond. But those probabilities are more remote. So a lot of things are allowed with a degree of uncertainty, and then there may be less restriction. So, you know, the fact that I'm here right now collapse sort of limits some of the possibilities about whether I'm here or not. But not completely. So this is again Einstein's that God doesn't play dice, that he didn't believe that everything was statistical. But when you're talking about the mind, think about it this way here. This is probably another way to think about it, is if your mind is seeing you here, right, like this, there's a scaffold that's being laid down over nothingness, okay? So there's nothing out there. So you have your energy. And if I were to take instruments and then I were to probe deeper and deeper into these particles, I would find out more and more about where those particles are being collapsed at that time. But eventually, if you get small enough, like to you know, like an electromagnetic wave, there's nothing less than that. And so what's between that, the electromagnetic, the energy? What's between it? Nothing. It's nothing. That's why there's uncertainty, because there is nothing there. It's the relation, the spatial-temporal relation. So you have uncertainty, and that uncertainty can build. And so say that electron going through the particle. Okay, you shoot the machine, the electron gun, and it's aimed at the little slit, and probably a pretty high probability it's going to go that way and not that way. So you can reduce that probability. But you can also reduce it, whether it's going to go through that hole or that hole. And again, but there's an uncertainty as to what it could do physically. And so until you actually observe it and lay the scaffolding of what it is, it could have all those possibilities, which is why when you observe it, it will do exactly one thing and go through exactly one hole. But if you don't, it's still an uncertainty. And it's only, and then it goes through both holes at the same time. And then when you observe it, you will find that, oh, it went through both holes. And so you go, okay, I watched it and it went through one. I didn't watch it and it went through both. That's because there's a physical, statistical chance, likelihood of a particle being somewhere if the gun is aimed that way, for instance. And that's true for any material event. There's a certain range of uncertainty. So what they can do with particles or any particles that they measure is they can actually measure, like I said, you know, with the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you can measure the location, you'll lose information about the temporal information or momentum, and vice versa. And so it turns out that when you collapse that uncertainty to one, that, you know, that is an event that, you know, has cause and effect consequences that then become part of your reality. But until you do that, it's uncertainty. In other words, it's not just out there. So it's whatever you observe, that is what the reality is. And then there's a certain spatial-temporal logic that is going to go with what will follow. But there's a lot of fluidity, you know, whether you trip down the stairs when you go down or you don't, you know, and, you know, that hasn't happened yet. So, and similarly for the past. So there is definitely a fluidity right down to the individual subatomic particles all the way up to you. And as you become a bigger object, the uncertainty that you are going to observe around here, like this isn't going to go through the wall like it might in a subatomic particle, where, you know, things can actually, you know, actually go through at a certain probability through actual objects. So that becomes hotter in the macroscopic world, but that doesn't mean that the same rules don't apply. So, you know, again, space and time will always be relative to the observer. That's what relativity, all those experiments show. Everything is always going to be relative to the observer. The only distinction biocentrism will have to the relativity theory is that they might say that, you know, an inanimate object might be able to pick up that relative. But and that's one of the criticisms people always say of biocentrism. And I always say, you know, but when I talked about that, the experiment where they send the particle through with the fork, there was a detector that measured that, just like a camera could take a picture. And it was only after, when they flipped the second switch, that what that detector measured changed. So it's not just that event changed, but the recording logic, that whole system changes. And that would be true for us. So that, you know, and that's what's hot, is the whole history of the universe, the whole universe is relative to what you're doing. And that's where the multiple world thing comes in, which is that all those possibilities, you know, are associated with a history. Just like you flip the switch on and it changed it to becoming a this or that, you know, there are a greater number of events like that you can modify. My philosophy is a little bit odd in that I mean, when you talk about intentions and fates and determinism and chaos and order and then you talk about nothingness and somethingness. I always think of all those words as relational, you know, and you can't have light without dark. You know, the idea of having something means nothing if there's not such thing as nothing. You can't have one without the other concept. The concept have no meaning if there's not one. So everything, all that information is just relational. So when you talk about intentions of their, you know, you're running into that same bit of a problem because what you're experiencing and what you do, because this comes back to those experiments that were all carried out, that when you make a decision to lift your finger, that actually that decision was actually made. You can actually measure it before you even made the decision to lift your finger. So you get even complicated when you talk about intentions along very real experiments like that. And those can be addressed, but again, it's the terminology and how you're using it. But I think... You know, if you're talking about intention, it's really your behavior. What you do is, if you go somewhere, you're collapsing probability waves. If I were to decide to turn here, I've made my intention what to do. And then there's a fluidity there that is different, even though I will never know it. And, you know, you could actually experience a different one, because that's the way they can actually go together. So, again, there are multiple possibilities to many events. And like I said, a lot of physicists believe anything that's physically possible has to happen. How can you have a state of nothingness? Because that's creating something. If you're having a state of nothing, you've created something. You've become God. There's no such thing as a state of nothingness. Those are silly ideas. Something and nothing. That's the whole thing. Is this solid or it's mainly empty, or is it stationary, or is it all these particles moving a trillion times around a second? It's at what level you're looking at this, and so what might be right at a superficial level is wrong when you look at it from a more detailed level. So when you're talking about something and nothing, you're creating your own conflict, because You've got something. Well, to have nothing is mean you're creating something. There's not a state of nothingness. That's how you'd then you got a dilemma of what came first, God. Where did God come from? They're all temporal things. You're creating a conflict with your own thinking. I'll try to use totally different words, because I'm going to get into trouble if I use any regular words. It's the universe is okay. I'll try to use different words. An information system. It's like that record I was talking about. It is just their relationships. That's all they are, and that's it. There are information relationships. They have nothing to do with space or time or something or nothing or nothing. It's just information relationships, and that is what exists. That's the record. Okay, your space and time are a way we're experiencing and we're doing it, and you'll be just as soon be gone as not be here. So that is why space and time work their way that way, is because they're both something and nothing according to the reasoning, if you follow it. So that they really don't contradict. It's only when we try to come up with some sort of terms that don't exist. I don't know if I'm making any sense. You could ask, what's the value of a flower or a tree or a rock? I mean, you know, it is. It just is. It is what it is. So you make your own value out of this. And, you know, for me, you know, I'm just saying, your experience in life, you know, if someone beats up your little child, what the value is in that. I mean, you experience in life and you have a sense of right and wrong and certain things, and you make your judgments, and that is what's important. You're experiencing life. There's no intrinsic good or bad, other than I can say is that if you punch someone in the end, there's absolute justice. It's just you don't know it. So just maybe being smart about it. In the end, if you're alive, you're experiencing life, and go for the ride. You know, it is. That's it. Just, you know, it is. I mean, you know, go out and smell the star jasmine, you know, whatever. But you know, you can also get too greedy about it, too. Again, the Spinoza transition, happiness is transition up and down, or Aristotle's gold median. If you go to the middle, you're not going to have as much extremes and pains, and you can be content. But you got to live according to your own constitution. So, you know, for some people, they want serenity, they want peace, and they want contentment. And you'd say, well, who wouldn't? No, I don't want that. I want turmoil and trouble. Of course, then when I have it, I don't want it. But, you know, and so they always say the keenest pleasures are for those who have the keenest pains. And, you know, but, you know, some of the people who I've known who I've respected the most in my life are self-actualized people who were always content, and I always admired how they were. But now that I had always have the option now to be that way, I you don't really want to do that. What it is is you go back to Maslow's stages of self-actualization. You know, we all have needs and wants, and so our first wants and needs are, you know, we need to be able to breathe, we need to have food, and then after we have that, then we're going to want friends, and then we're going to want to, then after that, you're going to want prestige, and you want people to respect what you think and you do. And after you get all of this, Maslow stage measured these people who, like Ben Franklin, these other people, what were they like? Once all your wants and needs were satisfied, what these people all had traits in common. They were philosophical, they were reflective, had a sense of humor. They, you know, so they had certain traits. So think about it. We have all these wants and needs, and once you don't have to worry about getting potatoes on the table and that sort of thing, you can turn to art and philosophy and be reflective, because you're not worrying about, you know, losing your leg or your kid dying. You know, so those immediate primary needs are being satisfied. So then things sort of shift. And who was it? One of the great philosophers said that perfection is death. Is you have no more reason to get up. Once you've had all your needs satisfied completely, you have no more wants or needs. If you want to really enjoy this water, you got to be thirsty first. Or if you want to have a good meal, you got to be hungry. You know, so you got to have the wants and the needs. But as soon as you satisfy them, you know, get your pleasure from them satisfied, they're gone. I think humans on the evolutionary scale are, you know, of what's possible in other possible forms of thinking, consciousness, or whatever, are like we're a little bit. We're just above the chipmunk, you know. So we get a hint of it, but we've collapsed this reality. We're at the point where human beings and the other 20 humanoid species are all extinct. So we're just the lucky one that's still here right now. But maybe in one of the other ones, they're the lucky ones. But you know, there's so many different things that are possible. I would say that surely in some of people who have understood the algorithms and have modified them, that, I mean, we're going to look very ridiculous. We'd look really ridiculous. I mean, and they would understand this. And actually, the truth of the matter is you can't, as a human being, understand it. It's not consistent with living. It's not consistent with that, because then everything would have no meaning. And I don't know who I'm going to contradict or offend here, but I always think that, you know, that someone defined passion as an inadequate idea. Once you cerebrally understand it, it goes away. You know, it does. It does. So you just live your life. I like to be like a kid, like a child, and just experience life. If you think about it, it's going to go away.